Members will call the meeting to order. The record shows we have a quorum, and so I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes with one correction. We have corrected the name of the spelling of the name of Representative Slawik to remove the K. Oh, remove the C. I'm sorry. We're removing the C, not the K. Very good.
Mr. Chairman, I have two N's in my name, too.
And you need only one or you need two?
I need two.
Okay, so we'll add an N to Representative Grinhagen's name. And we'll remove the C from Representative Slawik's name. And then I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes as amended. Representative Murphy. Representative Loeffler.
Just glancing at the minutes, I don't see my name listed, and I did enjoy the meeting.
You were here. Okay. Very good. We will add Representative Loeffler's name as attending. And with those changes, Representative Murphy, I assume you're okay with that?
Yep.
Very good. Okay, we have a motion to approve the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are approved. Introductions. I'm not sure that we need. We kind of went around and did that last time. I don't know that we have new members here to introduce. So we'll kind of skip over that for the moment. I did want to go over, if I could briefly, some of the materials you have in your packet. There's a lot of them, and we have a lot of material to go through today, so we'll move through that, and then we'll have a brief discussion about the rules too. I don't want to blow by those completely without getting committee input, but you have a list of obviously the agenda, the minutes. We'll talk about committee rules and procedures. There's a list of the members and staff for your reference, so you might want to hang on to that so we know who to turn to for information. The House Research has an issues list. We have a follow-up memo from the Office of MMB with information that was requested by the joint committee that we had last week. And then we have a number of materials. We have an article from Fran Bradley that I think you'll find rather interesting along the lines of reform. And then we have handouts that go along with our presenters today, a whole bunch of those. So if you want to turn for a moment to our Health and Human Services Reform Committee procedures piece, hopefully you've had a chance to look these over. And if you have any questions, any comments, now would be a good time to entertain those.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Were these distributed to us ahead of time, or did we just get them now?
Oh, excuse me. You just got them now, so... if you want to look them over, we could even come back and discuss them at our next meeting if we need to. My intent is not to slip anything by any members. I can tell you the process for me was to go through the rules or the procedures from all of the committees from previous session, kind of take the best of and put some of those in. But if you have any questions about these as we go forward, feel free to bring them up. And maybe today's not the time because you haven't had a time to look it over yet. Thank you. Okay, with that, I'll just make some introductory comments. Part of what we're trying to do today is to share with you how 4.3 million Minnesotans receive coverage. It's important for us as well as, we've talked a lot about government approaches, government programs, healthcare reform. But I thought it would be a good thing for us to think in terms of how people currently receive coverage in the private marketplace. Maybe dispel some myths, maybe help answer some questions, but in any case kind of give you that framework in which we can discuss reforms and other things. And so we'll start off with, we have Manny Munson-Regala from the Department of Commerce. Dr. Golden from the Department of Health, and
I'm Darcy Miner from the Department of Health.
Very good. Thank you. If you'd like to begin.
All right, Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Manny Munson-Regala, Acting Commissioner for the Department of Commerce. Starting tomorrow, I go back to my day job as Deputy Commissioner for the Market Assurance Division. Here to talk a little bit about what Commerce does with respect to regulating insurance products with an emphasis on health insurance products. So the first thing Commerce does is we review and approve the policy forms that are sold in the state of Minnesota. Before a health insurance product can be sold in the state, we take a look at that product to be sure it contains and conforms with all of the provisions and requirements of Minnesota law. But we don't stop there. We also look at the pricing charged for those products. So we get to tell you that the product that you file with us is consistent with Minnesota law, and then we look at the amount you want to charge for it. And we also perform that work on behalf of the health department with respect to HMO products. And the reason we're all up here today is you'll learn that the two agencies, Commerce and Health, work together to regulate the insurance, the private insurance marketplace. So we regulate the product, we regulate the pricing, we regulate the means of marketing that product. We are in charge of licensing the companies who sell insurance products, and we're in charge of licensing the agents who market those products. So we work with other states on conformity measures. We work with the affected individuals to be sure that what we're doing is done as efficiently as and as rationally as possible. But we get involved in the licensing of insurance agents and companies. We get involved in pre-licensing and continuing education course approvals. Agents have to maintain a certain number of CEs every year. Those courses are submitted to us for prior approval. Now, the companies that come to our state are examined, at least the ones who are Minnesota domestics, by our financial institutions division. They're the folks that make sure there's enough money in the coffers to be sure that those companies can pay the promises that they make to Minnesotans. So their primary job is to ensure the solvency and viability of insurance companies. We do that for our Minnesota domestics. Other states do that for their domestics. We share information with other states, and that's how the process of insurance financial solvency regulation works. We do some consumer education and outreach. We work with a number of our national regulatory associations, like the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, to do a number of both PSAs, consumer brochures, other items, helping consumers understand what an insurance product is, what a claims product is, or a claims process is, how do you, as a consumer, interact with the insurance marketplace. We have at Commerce a consumer response team. That's a team of phone consumer reps who take calls from consumers roughly around 5,000 a year or so on a range of different products, not just health insurance. But what they do is they try to resolve on an informal basis any dispute that a consumer may have with an insurance company. By way of illustration of the kind of work they do, they and the rest of Market Assurance generated somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 million additional claims payments for consumers on an annual basis. And that's, again, done informally. When the informal methods don't work, then I have the ability, under our market conduct powers, to do a more formal investigative process. So we send in a team of auditors or a single auditor into any of our licensees to be sure that their performance, their behavior, is consistent with Minnesota law. Lastly, in my shop, we have a division of insurance fraud. They are licensed peace officers. They have badges, and they carry, hopefully not around the office, weapons. But they get engaged in looking at insurance fraud allegations, and not surprisingly, a lot of health insurance cases end up in their portfolio. All right, and the next slide is going to be talking about the health products, the health insurance products that Commerce gets to look at. The first one, obviously, is health insurance, except for, and these are pretty big exceptions, self-insured employer plans and HMOs. We also look at Medicare supplement plans. We look at Medicare select plans, Medicare cost plans, accident-only plans, critical illness specified disease plans, like a cancer-only policy, for example, disability insurance, long-term care, and I put this bullet in there, any products claiming to fit in the above categories, because what we get engaged in is a number of products that don't technically fit those descriptions but are marketed as if they were major health insurance, if that occurs, then we have the ability to look at them and, at a minimum, take action for deceptive marketing practices. Stuff we don't regulate. If it's a self-insured health plan, and Dr. Golden will talk about how big of the marketplace that is, the U.S. Department of Labor gets involved in those plans. So one of the first calls we get when we get calls from consumers is we find out, is it a fully insured or self-insured plan? And if it's a self-insured plan, we have to steer them to the right agency. If it's a HMO, the Department of Health will get involved, then Ms. Miner will be talking about what they do over there. Medicare Part A, B, D, and Advantage, CMS gets involved in the regulation of those products. If you're a federal employee, you go to the U.S. Office of Personnel Management. If you're a state employee and you get your insurance through the State Employee Group Insurance Program, or CGIP, then MMB, Minnesota Management and Budget, is responsible for regulating those products. The medical assistance and state public programs, the Department of Human Services gets involved in that. And lastly, if you're purchasing a prescription drug discount program, the Minnesota AG has some limited oversight in that area. I know you have a number of presentations. We just wanted to give you contact information at Commerce that's relevant. We also left for you, since you are going to need a lot of homework, I suspect, is that we get a little leave-behind for you. What's in this packet is a glossary and list of acronyms, because health insurance, not surprisingly, has a ton of acronyms, a list of state and other web resources, a list of, based on our best intelligence, who's writing individual insurance products in the state of Minnesota, and a list of who's writing small employer products in the state of Minnesota. Directions about filing insurance complaints, life and health complaint form, request for external review, and lastly, private health insurance 101, written by the Kaiser Foundation. And that's my presentation, and I'll kick this to Mr. Golden.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Munson-Regala. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Munson-Regala. I seem to recall that it was like over 1,000 health policy forms that are reviewed by your agency annually. It's a very large number. Anyhow, if we could get information on kind of how it splits between these different types, I've never seen that. That would be useful.
Yeah, we can do that, and we'll follow up with a supplemental response.
Great.
Very good. Any other questions? We do have a number of presentations, but I don't want to, you know, if you've got a question, feel free to ask it. All right. Mr. Golden, if you could.
Mr. Chair, I'm Darcy Miner, and I'm the director of the Compliance Monitoring Division at the Department of Health. And my division regulates a number of health care providers, both facilities and individuals, and among those that we regulate is the HMO. We license health maintenance organizations under Minnesota Statute 62D. There are 8 HMOs in Minnesota, and the Commissioner of Health is charged to regulate HMOs for both financial solvency and quality assurance. Because there is more expertise on the financial solvency side within the Department of Commerce, we have chosen to, through an interagency agreement, we contract with the Department of Commerce, and they monitor for financial solvency on our behalf. The financial solvency review that they do, which is required by law to be done at least every 3 years, includes the review of the annual financial reports that come in, quarterly financial reports, and also a full financial exam every 3 years, as I mentioned. The quality side of the requirement for monitoring is handled actually through the Department of Health and with our own staff. Again, we are required to do a quality assurance exam at least every 3 years. And what we do during those exams, we do have staff who go on site. Unlike a nursing home review, it is actually an announced visit. Our staff contact the HMO before they come out. They advise them of the files that we'd like them to pull and let them know when we're going to be there. While on site, our staff review for the HMO internal quality program. They look at utilization review, at complaints and appeals, and also a review of the network adequacy. In addition, our staff investigate complaints that are actually filed by HMO enrollees. In addition to monitoring and regulating HMOs, our division also regulates county-based purchasing entities. There are three such entities in the state, and basically they are, as defined in statute, it is either a county board or a group of county boards who elect to purchase or provide through other providers health care services for residents whose health care is provided under medical assistance or under Minnesota care. As I mentioned, there are three county-based purchasers in Minnesota. Although we do not license them, they nevertheless are subject to the same HMO regulations as HMOs, and so when we do our quality exam, we use the same regulations. And Mr. Chair, that's my high-level overview, and I know Mr. Golden has more detail, but my contact information is also in the handouts.
Thank you, Ms. Miner. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Miner. Can you just talk a little bit more about the notion of an announced visit and the Department of Health's ability to look at records when you're doing an audit or a review, please?
Mr. Chair and Representative
Ms.
Murphy,
Miner.
I actually have the section manager with me as well, so if you'll want more detail than what I can give you, she can assist. We actually published in 2007 a rather large audit guide, which in effect gives the HMOs the opportunity to view it as an open book test. We're not out to kind of play gotcha. We let them know these are the things that we're going to be looking at. Of course, we don't tell them that far ahead of time exactly which files we're going to pull. But we try and pull individual files that will give us that broad cross-section that will fall into many different categories of care, some denials, and various types of care that enrollees may have needed. It takes probably a week on site. We generally send two auditors out, and what we have been doing for the past few years anyway is at the end of each day they debrief with whomever the HMO wants to sit in to let them know if we are failing to find certain information in files, and it gives them the chance to pull that information in for the next day if they have it. So it's more of a conversation in an attempt to make sure that we've looked everywhere to see what's actually in the files. We also look at their process, their procedures, making sure that if an enrollee wants to appeal a decision, that they've been given appropriate information of how and when to do that. So depending on the size, and all of our HMOs are, well, they vary quite a bit in size, but that would determine the number of files that are actually pulled. Again, we've revised our policies just within the past few years so that if we find one file only that has a deficient practice, we no longer cite the HMO as having a deficiency. In addition, if an HMO in doing its own quality assurance program comes across a practice that they realize is in violation of law or regulation and they begin to correct it themselves before we get there, we also do not cite that as a deficiency, since our goal is to have them be in compliance and not to have them with too many deficiencies. It's so is that enough of...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know time is tight, but just one follow-up question. So if you send notice ahead of time, sort of like an open book test, and the information that you're looking at is not sufficient, can you go beyond what you had sent in terms of notice in the current audit that you're doing?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, yes.
Ms. Meyer.
If we're on site and the files that we have do not show whatever it is we're looking for, we certainly can ask for additional files there. And again, that's part of what happens at the end of each day at the debrief, that we could express that based on the files we have, it looks like this is or isn't happening, and they can provide us with additional information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. If you'd like to proceed. Mr. Golden. Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden. I am the Division Director for the Division of Health Policy at the Department of Health. At the Department of Health, we have a number of programs which collect and analyze data about the Minnesota healthcare market. One of those programs is the Health Economics Program, which collects and analyzes a variety of data related to healthcare access, cost, utilization, and quality. One of the biggest users of our work are policymakers such as yourself, who are very interested in understanding the Minnesota healthcare market and how policy changes might impact that market. What I'll be sharing with you today is some information about how Minnesotans receive their healthcare coverage. I'll also take the opportunity to share some information about healthcare spending by source of that spending, as well as some information about the types of services, some trends in the spending, as well as some of our projections for spending into the future. The first slide that you see here is basically how people are receiving coverage today. So this is our most current estimates based on 2009 numbers. Based on the census data, there are approximately 5.3 million Minnesotans. About 63.7 of those Minnesotans are receiving their health care coverage through the private health insurance market. 25.3 of the Minnesotans have coverage through the fully insured products and are covered by the regulatory activities that have been described by Commissioner Munson-Ragala and Ms. Miner. Another 38.4% of Minnesotans are receiving their private health care coverage through self-insured products and are regulated by the Department of Labor at the federal level. Another 27.3% of Minnesotans have public coverage. 14.7% of those are in Medicare. 12% are on state public programs, and 0.5% is in MCHA, which is Minnesota's high-risk pool. The remaining 9% of Minnesotans are uninsured. That's approximately 480,000 individuals. About 85,000 of those are kids.
Dr. Golden, can you comment at all on that uninsured population? What do you have any breakdown for who's in that group? I think that would be interesting for our committee to know.
Mr. Chair and committee members, you know, we do have quite a lot of breakdown on that. We have it broken down by geographic area. We have it broken down by age. We have it broken down by race, ethnicity. We have some information about, for example, if employers are offering insurance, if there's take-up, if there's eligibility. You know, we have an entire slide deck that might be a little bit better, but we certainly have tremendous detail that breaks down that 9%. One of the things that we do every 2 years is a survey of Minnesotans. I think our last survey was about 12,000 Minnesotans to better understand who has insurance, who doesn't have insurance, and what are the various characteristics of those different individuals. I certainly could answer questions today, or we would be more than happy to come back and provide more information specifically about the uninsured as well.
Maybe that's a presentation for another time. Great. Thank you.
The numbers that were on...
One moment. Go on, Mr. Golden. Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Dr. Golden, I'm wondering if you could just give us a brief a primer, if you will, on the role of MCHA or why we have a high-risk pool in Minnesota.
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, I certainly can. I would be just as happy to turn that over to Mr. Commissioner Munson-Ragala as they work much more closely at the Department of Commerce with MCHA.
Mr. Munson-Ragala.
Mr. Chair, I said Murphy. So in an environment where health plans can decline participants on the basis of health status, or it's in a state where there's no guaranteed issue, policymakers said there needs to be an alternative for these folks to access medical insurance. The solution we selected in Minnesota was to set up a high-risk pool. And that's a pool that if you are a licensed health insurance carrier in the state of Minnesota, you need to be a participant in that pool. The pool provides coverage to those individuals. It does so at a premium capped at no more than 125% of market. Right now it is actually set at 123%. That's the charge. And it's intended to be sustained by the premiums collected from those individuals. But even at 123%, MCHA is running at a deficit in the neighborhood of, I'm going to get this wrong, but I think it's around $150 million or so. In order to fund that deficit, they assess all of the rest of the marketplace, and it's roughly 2.5% on each of our fully insured premiums go to sustain MCHA. And Dr. Golden will talk about, as that marketplace goes down, the assessment load on MCHA gets tougher because more people are moving to the self-insured market and they are not subject to the MCHA assessment.
Right. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good question. Dr. Golden?
Mr. Chair, the slide that is the next slide helps to provide some information about the trends that we see in Minnesotans' healthcare coverage. You have three data points that we have going from 1999 to...
Dr. Golden, just a moment. I've been wanting to make this comment since our first meeting. I think as a courtesy, and you'll see this in the committee procedures, if we could please turn off cell phones or at least silence them. I mean, I understand people need to keep in touch. We're in a very connected society these days, but if we could turn off the sound effects, it would be great. Thank you. Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this slide starts to show some of the trends in Minnesota's healthcare coverage from 1999 to 2009. The information in the far right column for 2009 is essentially the same one that was on the last slide. But what you will note is 1999 was coincidentally the high water mark for Minnesotans having health care coverage. That was the year that Minnesota had its lowest uninsured rate at 5.4%. Since that time, private health care coverage has declined from 72.2% to 63.7% in 2009. At the same time, public coverage has grown from 22.4% up to 27.3%. The largest portion of that growth in public coverage has come in the medical assistance program, although there is also an increase in the Medicare program, which is reflective of the aging of the Minnesota population. The other thing I would just note about this table, although MinnesotaCare has been reasonably consistent over the time period that is noted in the table, it's probably worth noting to the committee that the enrollment has increased markedly in 2010, and that is really reflective of the tough economic conditions that we are facing right now. The other thing of note is that 2009, the uninsured level has reached the highest proportion of the population since we began collecting this data at the department. This is largely a result of the economic downturn and is explained by the shock to the labor market. People losing their coverage because they've lost their job, they're working fewer hours and may not be eligible for their employer's insurance, and likewise their insurance is becoming increasingly unaffordable as their out-of-pocket costs are increasing.
Dr. Gold, one moment. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Golden. I just thought I'd share for the benefit of the committee. Maybe we'd want to see a little more detail on this at some point, but I served on a bipartisan small business insurance work group this summer, and we looked really at the coverage and how that changed. We looked at a little different time period than you were looking at, Dr. Golden, but what was striking to us was that over an extended period of time from 96 to 2009, the number of small employers under 50 that were offering health insurance stayed about the same. They dropped about 1%. The firms over 100 employees actually went up in terms of the number that were offering insurance from 94.5% to 97%. So our large employer group has been the group that has really seen significant drop in offering coverage to employers is the 50 to 99 employees group. And there's some policy options that could potentially be weighed there. But I think it's interesting to know that of these, in part of the reason why the small group has been stable, the under 50, is because we provide them with rate limits and some guaranteed issue protections that we might want to look at whether that should be broadened.
Good point. Good question. Dr. Golden, if you want to continue.
Mr. Chair, the next slide is taking a look specifically at the private health insurance coverage. As I said, it went from 72 to just under 64%. What you will see is in this slide we break it by the market size. So the large group market is for groups that are 51 individuals or larger. In the current time period, about 51.6% of Minnesotans are getting their coverage through large group. The small group market is for groups of individuals between 2 and 50 individuals. About 7.3% of Minnesotans are getting their coverage through that. That has been a decline over the years. And the individual market has been steady and is currently at 4.8% of Minnesotans. Another way to look at the healthcare in Minnesota, as opposed to by individual, would be to take a look at it by spending. The most current figures we have are for calendar year 2008, in which Minnesota's total healthcare spending was $35.1 billion. What this chart shows is the source of that funding, or more informally, who spent the money to receive the various services. In order of size, about 42.5% of the spending was through the private health insurance market, 18.4% was through medical assistance, 16.7% through Medicare, another 12.9% was out of pocket or from the enrollees or patients themselves, another 6.8% was from other public sources. This would include such things as MinnesotaCare, GAMC, and MCHA. And finally, another 2.7% was from other private sources. This would include such things as workers' comp and auto insurance. Another cut of that same $35.1 billion of total spending would be to take a look at what types of services the money was spent on. The largest category of expense is hospital services, and that represents 32.6% of the spending. Another 21.5% of spending goes for physician services. 15% of spending goes for long-term care, and that figure would include home health care. The next largest category is 14% of spending is the other spending. That would include such things as chemical dependency, mental health, durable medical goods, as well as non-medical or administrative health care spending as well. Prescription drugs was 9.6%. Dental about 3.9%, and the remaining 3.4% was on a variety of other professional services. The next slide takes a look at the private sector healthcare costs and compares it with other private sector indicators. What this slide shows is that healthcare costs are growing at an unsustainable rate, and that healthcare spending is becoming increasingly unaffordable. In taking a look at this slide, the top line, the red line, shows the growth in privately insured healthcare spending, and it excludes enrollee out-of-pocket spending. The next line down, the blue line, shows the growth in Minnesota's economy. The green line shows the increase in Minnesotans' per capita income. The yellow line shows the increase in our wages. And finally, the marine line shows the growth in inflation. I think what you will see over time is that they are separating, and that healthcare costs are growing substantially faster than income and wages, and that the increasing difference is making it more and more unaffordable to obtain private healthcare coverage.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Doctor. I had a question. I like your growth charts. Do you have one that covers the previous page 12 so that it shows the rate of growth of the major components? And there we know what components are growing faster, such as long-term care.
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have that information. I don't have that chart with me today, but we certainly could supply that to the committee and we can get that to you.
We could perhaps, you know, we could have an entire presentation on what's driving that accelerated increase. A lot of people look at inflation and say, why are healthcare costs going up so fast? And there's a number of answers to that, but part of it, frankly, is demographics. We're all aging and moving into those years, and we use a lot of healthcare. But that might be another presentation for another time to talk about what's driving that that inflation.
Mr. Chair, we would gladly come and talk about cost drivers. Mr. Chair, as I mentioned regarding the last slide that showed some of the spending, it did not include enrollees out-of-pocket spending. This slide does. What this slide focuses on is both the health plan cost as well as the enrollee's portion of the cost. And what we see in the blue portion of the graph is the health plan cost, and that has been rising steadily over time. It has more than doubled since 1999 to 2009. And these increasing costs explain the consistent increasing rise in healthcare premiums. Additionally, the gray portion of the slide shows the increase in the enrollees' out-of-pocket spending. In addition, the enrollees' annual share of cost has increased from $186 in 1999, where it was approximately 10% of the cost, to more than $731, or approximately 16% of the cost, in 2009. And hence, not only are premiums rising and increasing, but additionally, the enrollees' costs are increasing for a combined effect of making healthcare, again, ever increasingly unaffordable. The final slide that I have is from a new annual report that the legislature required the Department of Health to start doing in 2010. The intention of the overall report is to evaluate over time the healthcare reforms that were passed into law in the 2008 legislative session. The right side of this chart shows the projected healthcare spending in the absence of any state healthcare reforms, and then it's intended to compare that to actual spending with 2008 healthcare reforms in place. And because we actually are able to get and analyze the data on a two-year lag, the reason that this is the first year is this is where really the starting spot for the report. And so I think what it is important to understand is what the right side shows is what, if we had no reforms at all, what we are projecting at the department would be the increase in healthcare spending in Minnesota. So what the top line on the right shows is that in the absence of reforms, we project that the 2008 healthcare spending levels will grow from $35.1 billion to $69.6 billion in 2018. That is an average annual growth rate of 7.1%. The gray line that you see below that, so the lower line there in the chart, shows the projected growth in healthcare spending if you subtract out Medicare and long-term care. And so in the absence of any reforms, we project that healthcare spending, subtracting out Medicare and long-term care, will grow from $24.5 billion to $49 billion in 2018. That would be an annual average growth increase of 7.2%. And so over time, what will happen with this chart and the report that we're required to do for the legislature is you will start to see these lines relate to each other, and this will be one mechanism by which the legislature and policymakers will be able to evaluate reforms that were passed in 2008. But it is a convenient way now to see what would we be facing in Minnesota if we had no changes whatsoever. And so with that, I have some health. I have some additional information for contacting me, contacting some of our staff. We have the state health economist in our area, and we have quite a lot of information which I think will be helpful to you as you try to understand and deal with the healthcare market here in Minnesota.
Very good. Thank you for your presentations, both the Department of Commerce and Department of Health. Very good information for us to keep in mind as we're trying to understand healthcare coverage from both the private sector as well as the public sector. Yes, Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, if I could, before Dr. Golden leaves, I just have one quick question about one of these charts. On number 14, I wonder if this it's total cost per person, and is that spending or is that cost of premiums?
This would be total spending. So this is total spending. So what we do is we take a look at the total spending in the private market, and then what we do is we look at what portion of those transactions is the health plan paying, and then what portion of those costs are actually being paid out of the enrollee or the patient's pocket to receive those services.
Okay, Dr. Gold, now I've got a follow-up question. So as we look at, I'm looking at the last slide you showed, and this is the total cost of delivering care has been reduced or by healthcare reform from 2008, or are we talking about, help me understand the number a little bit better, because it's kind of an important point. If we're going to show that we're reducing healthcare spending by that much, is that spending, as Representative Liebling was pointing out, is that spending per person, or is this actually the amount of money that healthcare is costing, expenses?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I fully understand your question, but what this chart has is on the left side is our historical data that shows where actual trend has been. And again, the top line includes all healthcare spending. One very common thing that we take a look at is we subtract out Medicare and long-term care so that we focus more on actual healthcare delivery as opposed to some of the other pieces. What the second side is looking at is this is what the projection would have been from 2008 when the bill was passed in 2008 without any of the reforms there. And so what you will see over time is that the projections will be there. We will modify those for other changes in the system. But then what we will do is the actual will start to come over onto the right side, and that will give you the opportunity to take a look at, did the reforms that were passed in 2008, did they save money, did they cost money? So at this point, we're just at the starting spot because 2008 was when the bill was passed, of course.
I think what I'm looking at here is this claims paid, or is this taking into consideration things like unreimbursed medical care and cost shifting?
Mr. Chair, this would take into account all of the spending in Minnesota. So this takes into account all of the money that is actually spent on health care, regardless of the payer source.
Private and public.
Private and public, and out of the individual's pocket.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? I'm going to turn over the committee now to our Vice Chair, Representative Mack, and let her introduce our next presenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have Catherine Commit from the Minnesota Council on Health Plans, and it's my understanding we don't have a PowerPoint, so if members want to refer to the handout that's in their packet from the council, and with that, you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Catherine Commit, and I am the Director of Policy and Government Affairs at the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. You should have a packet in your folder. Because we heard so much good information from the Departments of Commerce and Health, I'm going to abbreviate my presentation because a lot of what I was going to cover they've already covered. So we'll go through this kind of quickly. The Minnesota Council of Health Plans represents seven health plans in Minnesota of varying sizes. A lot of these health plans, you probably already know their names, Blue Cross and Blue Shield, Health Partners, Medica, but there are some others that you may not be familiar with. For example, Metropolitan Health Plan, Sanford Health Plan is a health plan that's based out of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We also have Preferred One and UCARE as members. The Minnesota Council of Health Plans provides coverage to more than 4.3 million Minnesotans. And I think in Dr. Golden's presentation, he referenced the fact that there was approximately $35 billion in healthcare spending throughout the state. I think it was 2009. That's total spending. That's government programs, everything, private coverage. But the amount of that figure is about $17 billion that flowed through the health plans. So $17 billion was spent on health care through my members, and that money was in turn paid out in the forms of claims to providers and hospitals, as well as some of it was used to administer these products. The health plans employ roughly 16,000 people across the state of Minnesota, and they are regulated as nonprofit healthcare organizations. So all my members are nonprofit health plans. They are not for-profit entities. There's a one large plan here in Minnesota that is a for-profit company. That's not my member. My members are locally based, and they serve the community. They're mission-driven and are focused on reinvesting any profits or back into the community. So again, they're regulated under chapters 62A, C, and D, and that's important because those bills that relate to those chapters flow through your committee. Just to give you a little historical perspective, most industrialized countries have a socialized system of health care where the coverage is provided as a government benefit. But in the United States, we followed a different path. Wage freezes during World War II led employers to offer benefits as a way to compete for workers. And then after the war was over, they just continued to compete by offering benefits. And so the United States has really evolved into a different system where it's an employer-based system. Most people get their coverage through their employer, at least most people under the age of 65. And so a question for you is, why even have insurance? I think that I know I've talked to some people who are from another country, and it's pretty it seems pretty ridiculous to have to pay for something that you hope you'll never use. So why, if you're perfectly healthy, why would you want to have insurance? Fortunately, most of us are healthy most of the time, but sooner or later, almost all of us will need extensive and expensive health care. So the purpose of insurance is to pool as many people together to spread or share the costs generated by a small number of people. Excuse me. Over the long run, risk pooling makes sense because almost everybody eventually needs expensive health care. It's much more manageable to pay an average amount or a premium rather than to get hit all at once by medical bills that can reach the tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. And in any given year, just 1% of the population accounts for almost 25% of all healthcare spending in the U.S. The sickest 5% of the people account for roughly 50% of the cost of total spending. But in contrast, the healthiest 50% of the population accounts for just 3% of total healthcare spending. So the next slide talks a little bit about what is the difference between managed care and a traditional fee-for-service model. A traditional fee-for-service model is what most of us probably grew up with. It was a major medical plan. If you got sick, it was something that you probably used that product for your hospitalization and that sort of thing. And in the 1970s, HMOs came onto the scene, and they tried to provide a different model that would promote wellness and prevention to help people stay healthier so that they wouldn't have to use the healthcare system and incur higher costs later on down the road. Today, managed care is really throughout the entire health insurance industry. It's involved in a whole spectrum of products, including HMO products as well as insurance products, and most products do employ managed care techniques to ensure access and control cost. Just some of the things that makes a managed care plan a little bit different than a traditional indemnity or insurance product is that for example, will guarantee access to a network of credentialed providers. So instead of you having to go out, which is how we used to have to do it, try and find a physician or a provider who would see you for whatever your condition, the health plans have done that for you to identify who are the very best providers, and also by virtue of having a certain amount of volume, they're able to drive down the cost by contracting with those providers. I'm going to skip the next slide 7, except to say one thing, because you've already heard a little bit about how we're regulated, but I would just point out that as policymakers, you have a big role to play in the direction of how healthcare is structured in this state. And your role is really to review and set policy direction, and one of your big challenges is to balance the ever-increasing demand for services against limited healthcare resources. So that's where you come into play. I'm going to just briefly mention on slide 8 that, again, as the Department of Commerce mentioned, they are really focused on making sure that we are solvent, that we have enough reserves to pay the claims that are that we're incurring with our population that we cover. As in terms of a government role, though, for regulation, I want to point out that the federal government really is the one that sets national rules, a national framework, but it's the states that's that really are the primary regulators of health insurance in Minnesota. And so the rules are going to vary by state and by insurance market. So what we do in Minnesota is going to be probably different than what we do in, or what is done in Louisiana or the state of Maine and that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
Ms. Commit, I was asking a question earlier about MCHA, and I think you're going to talk about it a little bit later, but I'm wondering if you can help us understand if there is a relationship between your solvency and MCHA, the creation of MCHA in the state of Minnesota. So MCHA is the place where people who are denied insurance go, right, because they're high risk. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering how that contributes to the solvency of Minnesota's health plans.
Ms. Commit.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Murphy. I'm not really sure how to answer that question. I guess I would have to get more information. I'm not sure what the answer is to that. So let me research that, and I'll get back to you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Ms. Commit. And I'm just curious, do you think there's a relationship between the two?
Ms. Commit.
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, I mean, I suppose that the reason that an insurance company would the reason an insurance company underwrites is to determine whether or not they're able to or willing to take the risk. And so I suppose if there's a risk that looks like it would be problematic, they would or they can't price for it, then that might be a case where they would deny that coverage. That so it probably does relate to that, but unfortunately I don't have the specifics of that. But I will follow up with you.
Thank you, Ms. Commit. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, you know, as we look at risk in terms of MCHA, I mean, it is one of the mechanisms in the state of Minnesota that has allowed us to get to the kind of coverage levels we've gotten to, because it takes the outliers, if you will, the people who are highest risk, and assesses that risk across the entire market through this mechanism called MCHA. In that sense, it probably protects the health plans and the insurers from insolvency. It protects them from the kind of fluctuations that could really do damage to their solvency. So I suspect from that perspective, what Representative Murphy's talking about is absolutely true. But it's important to note that, and I think perhaps our other presenters might comment on this as well, that the function of MCHA in the state of Minnesota has really allowed us, and we're now seeing interest in this on the national level, to actually have a reinsurance pool to take care of people who are at higher risk of being, you know, large expenses to the marketplace. So it certainly is one of those mechanisms that helps the insurance marketplace work in Minnesota to provide more coverage for more people. And I would defer to the health plans to give the details on that, but that's my understanding of it.
I'll talk to some of the experts. You're welcome. So looking at...
Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, just kind of continuing on a little bit with this topic, and before the Affordable Care Act, Ms. Commit, can your members or did your members, if somebody ran up too many expenses, would they be eventually dropped? I mean, we have the underwriting process at the front end, but on the back end, if somebody, you know, had too many expenses, would they then be denied coverage and then head off to MCHA or be uninsured or whatever?
Ms. Commit.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, if that person enrollee had purchased through the fully insured market, The answer is no, because once they have insurance, they have guaranteed renewability. So once they're covered, they're able to continue to be covered, provided that they pay the premium and that sort of thing. So the company does not get to decide, we're going to get rid of you. That it doesn't work that way. So they do have guaranteed renewability.
Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what about the lifetime limits issue? In Minnesota, did we have people with your members' policies, are there lifetime limits that people would hit and then that would be it for them? And also to follow up on your first response, is that different than other states?
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, I'll answer your second question first. Yes, I think it is different than other states. Minnesota is far and above much more consumer protection oriented than other states. So a number of things like guaranteed renewability or guaranteed issue in the small group market were things that were changed in state law as a result of the 1992 Minnesota Care reforms that went into place. In addition to Minnesota Care, the Minnesota Care program being enacted, there were also a number of small group reforms that were enacted, and these were part of those reforms. Following up on your first question regarding lifetime limits, you know, I'm going to have to get back to you. I know that there are some lifetime limits that occur, but there are also, I think it's in the under HMO law that there are no limits. So it depends on what product is purchased. If it's purchased under a 62A, there may be some limits that are allowed, but under 62D, I believe there are no limits. But let me check on that, and I'll get back to you.
Thank you.
And just to let you know, Ms. Commit, we have about 10 minutes left for this portion of the presentation.
Okay, very good. So,
one more question. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, Madam Chair, just a clarification on the cancellation question. Having been involved with the health insurance industry for 30 years, where we find that cancellation is in the group market when people lose their job or switch jobs and they're on COBRA. They either can't afford the COBRA premiums or they exhaust COBRA and then they wind up canceled or get a high price conversion off of that. And that's where, coming off the group plans is where people get confused with this idea that people are being canceled. My personal opinion, after watching the system work for 30 years, we would be well served in Minnesota if we could come up with a reform where people had their own health insurance policy, not tied to a group. When they lost their job or had to change jobs, they would not lose their coverage and would not have to requalify. That would create a much smoother transition, and we wouldn't have these gaps in coverage, nor would we have this shock of COBRA premium that people are experiencing today. I could elaborate on that for about another hour, but I'll restrain myself. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Ms. Commit, if you want to proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. On slide 9, we just talk a little bit about private commercial coverage, and that, as I mentioned earlier, most people get their coverage through their employer, but there are situations where people purchase coverage individually, and Dr. Golden talked about roughly 4.5% to 5% of the population gets coverage through an individual product. The employer-sponsored coverage is typically, I'm on slide 10 now, is typically comprehensive, but not always. There are variations in benefits as well as premiums and deductible costs. Individual purchased policies are typically a little bit less comprehensive and in order to make them more affordable for an individual to purchase. They often have higher deductibles as well. I just want to recap here to remember that the reason to buy insurance is to eliminate or minimize the risk. So in exchange for a premium, the risk is transferred to the insurance company or the health plan. And I'll just relate a little story about my own organization. We have 5 people in my organization. It's pretty small. We don't have enough resources in our budget to be able to self-fund. So in exchange for a premium that we pay a health plan, we give to them the premium and say, now you guys take all the risk. You're on the hook to manage our risk for the entire year. And in exchange, we'll give you this premium. And they say, okay, and and they're on the hook. Next year, when they look at our insurance product, they might say, or our insurance policy, they might say, you know what, we think that you didn't do a very good job staying healthy this year, so we're going to have to raise, you had a lot of claims, we're going to have to raise your rates a little bit. But we are the ones who, we shift that risk over to the insurance company. The reason that's important to understand is because those products where the insurance risk is shifted, those are the products that you have control over as state regulators. You are, those products are called fully insured products. My organization does not take the insurance risk itself. Now, if I were working for a large corporation, it's probably the case where, because the corporation has enough resources itself, it's going to self-insure or self-fund all of its own claims for its employees. And in that case, and that gets into a little bit on, gets to the slide on page 11, in large employers typically do that because there are some real tax advantages and other regulatory advantages to providing coverage for their employees that way. So in that case, the employer is itself sort of the insurance company for their employees. They pay the claims of all the insurance or medical claims for their employees. What the large employer might do, I mean, the state of Minnesota, for example, is this way. So the CGIP program that you're covered under is covered this way. But what the state of Minnesota, like other large employers, what they do is they don't have the expertise to pay claims and contract with providers and that sort of thing, so they hire a health plan or an insurance company to administer the benefit package for their employees. But when it comes time to pay the claims come from the employer, are paid by the employer. And that's an important distinction to appreciate because, again, as policymakers, you have control over that portion of the market that is fully insured. So those smaller products that are governed by the Department of Commerce and Department of Health. But there's a lot of, as I think the Department of Health was mentioning earlier, Dr. Golden, about a sizable portion of the Minnesota population is covered under these self-funded plans. And while it looks like they may be covered under the same kinds of health plans that are my members, they in fact may be only having their health insurance benefit package administered through that health plan, when in fact it's the employer itself who is paying the claims. And why that's relevant, or why that happens, is because large multi-state or multinational corporations don't want to be held to following the laws in 50 different states. And so under this federal law, which is called ERISA, ERISA stands for the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. That's a law that protects, that deals with pensions and health benefits, a federal law. But it really has evolved over the years to be a way for large employers to self-insure their benefits for their employees, and as a result, they're preempted from any state regulation of employee health benefits, and they're preempted from paying any of the taxes, the state tax, health care taxes that that the fully insured market has to pay in Minnesota. So, for example, we were talking about the MCHA assessment earlier. The MCHA assessment is not assessed onto anyone who has a coverage through a self-funded plan. So the MCHA assessment is one thing. There are other premium taxes that are also paid, but those are paid only on the fully insured market, not the self-funded market. I spend a lot of time on that because it's oftentimes I hear a request from a legislator saying, "Do you have somebody? My constituents having a problem." I can't believe you guys are doing this because it's not, that seems illegal. And I look into it a little deeper and find out, unfortunately, it's a self-funded plan. It's a large employer who is making some of those coverage decisions as well as how to administer the plan. And so in those circumstances, you don't have as much regulatory authority as you would over a fully insured plan. So, enough about that. Let me, I'm almost finished here. Just wanted to show you a picture just to illustrate on page 12, a picture of how those taxes add up and affect the fully insured market a little bit differently than the self-funded market. I'm not going to talk about Medicaid and Medicare, except to say that in Minnesota made a decision to require HMOs to have to participate and cover people covered by the state medical assistance program and the Minnesota Care program. So all of my health plans participate in state public programs, and it is a requirement in order to, as it's a condition of licensure, actually, in the state of Minnesota. I'm going to skip slide 15 because you've already gotten all this information, slide 16, and just recap that, you know, fortunately, Minnesota has been a leader in so many different ways. We still have one of the highest rates of health insurance coverage in the U.S., even though we have 9% uninsured. We're still much, much better off than most other states. I mean, Texas has a 25% uninsured rate. We are doing some good things here. We need to do better. I can tell you that with the recession and with rising health care costs, maintaining affordable coverage is still a concern for employers. And our statistics show that between 2004 and 2009, more than 82,600 people lost coverage in the small group market. So for the reasons that were already articulated before, with the downturn in the economy, people losing their jobs, losing coverage, it's been tough out there. We offer a variety of products, traditional products, as well as more contemporary products that have HSAs attached to them, as well as provide administrative services to self-funded employers. What insurance costs is going to depend on what is covered. It's going to depend on who is covered and what the underlying health care costs are, as well as what it costs to actually provide the coverage. Health care premiums are what they are because they reflect the cost of health care. So it's health care costs that drive the amount of premiums. There's a graphic in there that shows on page 22 that shows where the premium dollar is spent. These are the premiums that are collected by my members and give you a sense of where they all go. I'll just speak a little bit about administrative costs and let you know that for every $1 of premium revenue, about 9 cents is spent on administrative costs. And 20% of that 9 cents pays for customer service, detection of fraud and prevention, health education, disease management, quality assurance, provider relations, et cetera. 27% of that 9 cents pays for taxes and assessments. And then just over 50% of that 9 cents goes for things like billing and enrollment, claims processing, underwriting, marketing, and general administration. Again, just to sum up, Minnesota is really one of the healthiest states. We need to keep doing a good job and do a better job. We have a low rate of uninsured, high rate of private coverage. But I think in addition to having the excellent providers here in Minnesota, the high quality, low cost hospitals and other providers combined with the nonprofit, locally based health plans, I think that all of those things have contributed to a successful state of affairs for Minnesota's healthcare system. We still have challenges. We have to do something about the growing number of uninsured. We still have to tackle rising healthcare costs. As I mentioned, those equal rising premiums. We need to do more to address health disparities. And with the rising cost of care, there's been a real incentive for smaller employers to jump out of that fully insured market to try to avoid paying the additional costs of regulation, taxes, mandates, and those sorts of things. They try to become a self-funded group, which gets pretty difficult to do for groups of about 100 people or so. And it can actually be financially kind of risky to do. So with that, you have my contact information. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. And would like to be a resource to you throughout the session.
Representative Kiffmeyer has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I do. I remember that in our last legislative session in 2010, I know there was a fairly substantial discussion about this increasing from 2 to 49 employees and taking that up to the 99. And I'm not quite sure. I know that sometimes you're presenting numbers based upon what was. There's a little bit of a lag to that. But I would just like someone to address it, if you might do that. Were there legislative changes to enhancing that area? And was that accomplished? And then secondly, if so, you can speak to the effect that might have in the future. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't know exactly, or Madam Chairman, exactly which testifier can address that. I'm sure possibly Ms. Kmit could do that, or others as well.
Madam Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I actually might refer that question to Representative Loeffler, because she was the chief author of that legislation last year. And that was, as she mentioned earlier, there was a small group reform work group that met over the summer and fall to look at those very issues. So nothing was changed in state law, but a study was created. This work group was created to look at some of those issues. There are some changes that are due to happen as a result of federal health care reform in several years, looking at addressing the group size. But I don't know if Representative Loeffler has anything else she wants to add.
Representative Loeffler, do you want to take that on? Otherwise, it looks like Mr. Munson-Ragala might have an answer.
Madam Chair and members, the work group met through the summer. It hasn't finished its work. It was awaiting some additional information that was being gathered by the Department of Health and Commerce on potential impacts. This has been a controversial issue because there's some who would like to move forward fast in order to help those 50 to 100 employee small businesses move forward. There's others who would like to let that market remain unregulated until the federal deadline of 2014. And they haven't completed their final work. And I don't think we've heard yet when that information is going to be available.
Mr. Munson-Ragala, would you like a final word on the issue?
Sure, Madam Chair. This might not be a final word, though. Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I think you might be thinking about the changes to the flexible benefit law that you guys approved last session. And what we did was, the existing law allowed for some creativity for plans to file products with us that didn't meet all of the Minnesota mandates for a certain defined set of insureds. You expanded the group of insureds that applied to two groups to 100, and you applied it to the individual marketplace. That's what happened last session. I think that might have been what you were thinking about.
Representative Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I believe that is it. That's the key component of that it seemed as though we had made a step forward in that area, but only in a defined, specified way. And I appreciate that information to clarify that. And yet, yes, room for improvement, without a doubt. But I like Representative Grunhagen's approach to do that, and I think that would be even more helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, Ms. Kmit, for your presentation. And we will move forward with Greg Dottillo and John Tyler from the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. Do you want to proceed?
Madam Chair, well.
Proceed.
Madam Chair, well.
Yes, Representative Liebling.
Thank you. I just a kind of a general comment, maybe while we're waiting for the next testifier. Ms. Kmit made very little mention of the new federal health care reforms, the Affordable Care Act, which we know is now the law and is going to make substantial changes to insurance in Minnesota. And it is complicated. This whole subject is complicated. And I guess it would be, I think, helpful if, as we move forward, if we could get the testifiers, or maybe even have a separate presentation on what those changes are going to be, so that I feel like we're talking about something that is substantially changed, and for us to understand what our role is going to be moving forward and what we can affect, we obviously need to understand what changes have been made at the federal level and what changes are still there that we as state legislators have to make decisions about and can impact. So just with that comment, I think I almost felt for a while there like I was sort of in a parallel universe that we're hearing about something that we all know has been changed in significant ways, and we may not understand exactly how, but we can't really just talk about it as though that hadn't happened, and we're just going to go on the same path.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, and I believe the chair would like to speak to that. Representative Gottwalt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, we're not talking about this in isolation. I think we are, in fact, talking about how people currently receive health care coverage here as one piece of information. It's fully my intent as chair of this committee to have some information about how federal reforms are impacting the marketplace and how we receive coverage. So we're not trying to ignore it at all. But I think it does make sense to kind of look at these things. We have, over the last 4 years I've been in the legislature, done very little to look at the private insurance market at all in any level of detail. And I think it's helpful to have this background, especially as we talk about how the changes at the federal level may be impacting it. So there is no intent to ignore that at all. In fact, I fully intend to have a presentation or two or three or four maybe about how the federal changes are going to be impacting the state of Minnesota, because you're right, that is going to impact the decisions that we make as a policymaking body.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if we want to move forward, if you gentlemen would like to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, we have about 25 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Tyler. I'm with Boies & Tyler Financial Group, a professional insurance agency that works in the areas of individual insurance, small and medium-sized employer, fully insured plans, as well as large employer self-insured plans, as well as the retiree population as well. I'm also a participant in the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters as well. I work on their legislative committee with my associate, Greg Dottillo.
My name is Greg Dottillo. I am the incoming president of MAHU, Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. I'm also an agent for 35 years. I have a firm that employs a dozen individuals in the delivery of health care in the state of Minnesota.
Okay, great. Before we begin with the slideshow that we have on the monitor there, what we'd like to do is just quickly refer to this particular piece that should be in your materials. It discusses the role of the professional insurance agent and really what we do. So I'll just briefly touch on this before Greg gets into the balance of the presentation. We are licensed insurance professionals that really are licensed to insure the uninsured is primarily the job that we do in really in all areas of the private market. A good part of what we do, though, is not directly involved with the actual sale of insurance and administration of insurance. Actually, we're there as professional advisors and financial analysts as well for our business clients as well. And there is a lot of involvement with regulations, rules, both at a federal and state level, to essentially keep our clients, as they say, out of jail. To make sure they do everything, they comply with the rules and regulations that can be quite significant. So we work with both with in-house employees that offer things like COBRA administration, flexible spending account administration, ERISA compliance, Department of Labor regulatory compliance, flexible spending accounts, health savings account programs, and so on and so forth, as well as insurance. So we tend to wear a lot of hats. And so on the top section there, you see we are actually involved with government regulations as well as insurance companies, and we represent insurance companies as well. And part of what we do is to make sure that we properly are aware of what the insurance companies have to offer, but also properly explain how they work to our clients as well. So we also are to a degree involved with healthcare providers, because what we do, we are the financial engine. The insurance companies that we represent are the financial engine that pays for significant, as Catherine indicated before us here, many billions of dollars worth of actual claims. So we actually fund the private sector to a very large degree as far as healthcare providers are concerned. We interact with the general public, and we also are involved with to a degree of healthcare banking as well, to the degree that banks administer health savings account plans and flexible spending account plans and those kinds of things. In the center section there, we talk about what we do every day, and we're basically the boots on the ground. We interface with the public on a daily basis. As far as providing interpretation of what insurance is. Insurance is basically healthcare by contract, and so that's a very involved legal type of operation. But essentially what we do is insure the uninsured, either through small employers, individuals, and large employers as well.
Great. Thanks, John. I am honored to present in front of this group, because I do know some of you, and I do know there's some very smart people on this committee. And I am looking forward to your questions. However, if I could kind of get through the presentation, but if you can't hold back, you know, that's fine also. But our first slide here talks about who we represent. And right now, our industry is about 2.4 million individuals in Minnesota that we actually are committed to in delivering their health insurance coverage. And approximately 80% of employers actually rely on our industry to do as what John was saying. Now, MAHU members, we're all licensed, as Manny brought up. You know, he kind of makes sure we, you know, stay in line and we're, you know, pass our, you know, our tests and our continuing ed and everything. But we've got brokers, agents, consultants, and insurance companies that is really part of our organization. And we not only do the medical, but we also do the dental, the disability, and the group insurance, basically your employee benefits. There's 58,000 licensed health insurance agents, according to Commerce, in the state of Minnesota. That's how many are actually licensed in Minnesota. And we've got a coalition of groups, MAHU, Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. That's the group I'm involved with. Then there's NAFA, the National Association of Independent Financial Advisors. Then you have the independent insurance agents, and then you got the professional insurance agents. The mission of the coalition is to present a unit voice, and I was kind of, John and I were selected to present in front of you today. So, now, how does the market work? Now, I know I'm going to insult some of you because this is kind of 101, but, you know, here, just hang with me, okay? Healthcare consumers, we're all healthcare consumers, and then there's healthcare providers. Really, that's all you need. You don't really need us. Why? Well, because the price, the reason you do need us is because of the price of health insurance or of health care. That's why you need us, is because the insurance company bands money together. So you have life-saving health care services are too expensive for most people. And basically what we do is just we pool everybody's money together to pay for unexpected and expected medical costs. Now, if it's car insurance, homeowners insurance, liability insurance, all those are insurance, are unexpected costs. But we also cover expected costs called preventative care and whatever. And that's one of the reasons why our stuff costs so much, is because we're not only supposed to cover unexpected, but we're also supposed to cover expected. So here, insurance companies pull money to pay medical claims. Now, the first obligation of the insurance company is to protect the enrolled individuals from that's currently in the insurance company. Okay? So here, with large health care claims, so if I bring somebody to the insurance company that has a large claim because they didn't have insurance and they didn't think they needed insurance, but now they need insurance, and they know they're going to have a $1 million claim, okay, which we see all the time. They want to get into the insurance company. Well, the insurance company is going to have an issue about that. Why? Because their first obligation is to its policyholders. Because if they allow that person to come in, who do you think is paying for all their claims? The insurance company? No, it's their policyholders that's paying it. Now, individuals transfer financial risk from themselves to the insurance company. The insurance premiums are the price you pay for insurance coverage. The total premiums must pay all medical claims plus the admin cost. And you've been seeing different numbers, 7.9%, 9.2%, whatever. You know, this is without the taxes and assessments. Medical claim spending is a chief driver of the premium. It's not admin cost. I mean, you saw from the doctor here the escalation of cost. If it goes up 7%, that's what the admin cost is. So just 1 year of increased cost really wipes out the administration. What drives the cost is claims.
Yes. Excuse me for just one second. Mr. Chair has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's a very important point, that second bullet point. I get the question a lot from people who don't understand the insurance market as well. This whole idea of administrative costs, and the debate sometimes comes down between public sector administrative costs versus private sector. And what you said is very important. The cost of the agents and what they make and so forth is part of that 9.7% that Ms. Commit testified to earlier. So that's important to understand. That's part of administration. All the services that are provided by the agents are done as part of that administrative cost.
Thank you.
Mr. DiTillo.
Okay, thank you. Actually, there's a, and I don't want to throw you off the presentation, but there is a, inside your packet, there is some myths and misconceptions about health insurance. And that's actually the first point. And it's got private insurance admin costs is 40%. I mean, that's been a very common thing. So, you know, when you have time, this actually blows up a lot of the myths that you've been hearing, especially during election time. Okay. Now, 2010 increases in healthcare spending was due to increased unit costs, not patient utilization. Now, where's that from is Milliman and Company, okay? They're the ones that have been studying this since the 1940s, okay? So the unit cost is, and it, what it used to be was utilization, people running to the doctor more often. But what has happened is the market, especially in Minnesota, has changed where these consumer-driven health plans where somebody has to now start paying money out of their pocket to get health care, they're finding out that the amount of times they run to the doctor is not as often as it was when somebody else was paying for it. So here in 2010, the reason that that line's going up was because of increased unit cost, not people running to the doctor as often, according to Milliman. Now, insurance companies, the stability of health insurance premiums allow for continuation of adequate income which to pay claims. That's the key thing, and that's what we're all together on here. We all want the cost of health care to become stable. Because when it becomes stable, then your healthy risk don't leave the pool. And we'll get into this right now. The process of risk management is called underwriting. And I know that's a dirty word to some. But, you know, underwriting is what balances new risk entering the pool against the obligation to pay future claims for existing insured individuals. Okay? So the underwriting basically protects the current policyholders from somebody gaming the system. Now, employer group insurance. You have, yes.
Madam Chair. Excuse me, Representative Murphy. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I think this is a really important point, and I just want to say that I don't think of underwriting as a dirty word, but I think it's important for us to understand it. And I appreciate you, you know, making it clear that the first obligation is to those who have a policy. So then you look at new risk and judge it. What does that mean in practical purposes? What does that mean when you're thinking about the new risk, how it fits in the current specter of current enrollees and where they go if they don't fit in?
Okay.
Mr. DiTillo.
Okay. Thank you. Right now, we have guarantee issue, which means that the individual market will allow people to go to MCHA to get coverage. And that there is why your individual health insurance is actually cost less than group insurance. That's one of the reasons, because of underwriting, plus you got mandates, blah, 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 okay? And so here, right now in the current marketplace, the next couple slides will actually really explain that. May I just go into that, and we'll expand exactly. That's a great question. Okay, thank you. Okay. Employer group insurance, as you heard, 2 to 50, large 51+. There's fully insured. There's self-insured. Each insurance company has one pool for all the employers with 2 to 50. Now, is there one big pool for all 2 to 50? For all the insurance companies? No, it's one pool per insurance company. Okay, and who regulates those rates is Commerce. So right now, the law says they got to pay out 82 cents on a dollar. Okay, so here, policies are guaranteed issue with HIPAA pre-existing. Guarantee issue means what? They're guaranteed coverage. It says existing protection for the risk pool and responsible individuals. So if somebody switches from one job to the other and they don't go without coverage for more than 63 days, then there is no pre-X, and that's the federal law. Employers have price predictability with protection on allowable rate increases. On small group, the highest increase that they could get due to risk is 15%. Okay, so there's protection for a small group if they do have a large claim in there. Almost all small groups are fully insured. The risk is transferred to the insurance company. Self-insured means the employer would pay for it. There's no reinsurers that will that really write for a small group. So employer, so you know that shift from fully insured to self-insured, that's happening with the larger group market, basically 100 plus. Employers with more than 50 employees, 51 to 1,000, are either fully insured or self-insured. 1,000 is usually self-insured. Self-insured, they buy what they call stop loss. So if they have a catastrophic claim, let's say they have preemie babies that cost $500,000 a piece, the employer would only be charged $100,000, and then the stop loss policy would pay the other $400,000. Okay, now there's a shift from fully insured to self-insured group plans, and everybody agrees on that with all the data from DOH. Now, here's the big thing, and right now, 5.3% is in taxes and assessments. Okay, so that's the incentive. That's why employers want to become self-insured. I'm just telling you. They go, oh, I just got a 6% increase on my health insurance, but if I go self-insured, I just wiped it on out. I'm in. You know, when you're thinking that their premium's $4 million, 5% of $4 million is $200,000, okay? So this is an easy way of saving, but it's just a one-time shot. Now, government and private insurance both use underwriting, and this is where I'll come back and ask or give the explanation of the earlier question. Okay, government underwriting eligibility is to protect government's budget. Okay, so there is government underwriting. They do it with income, assets, and financial status. They do it by age, gender, marital status. So all your different government programs have to pass. If they're employed, a lot of them, you know, you got to, like Minnesota Care, you can't be employed for the last 5 months. So there's underwriting process with the government programs. Why? Because you have to protect your budget. Now, insurance companies do the same thing. They have to protect the pool through underwriting. Now, health status, pre-existing conditions to calculate future costs of the insurance pool. That's basically their main concern is the health status. All they care about is how much money are we going to receive and how much money are we going to pay out. That's the bottom line in regards to risk. Now, this here, underwriting example, John is an uninsured individual. It's not this John, okay? Has had no health care expense but falls ill. Needs $1,000 a month of lifetime medical care. Premium to join the individual pool is $400 per month. Now, underwriting must protect the current pool enrollees and says no to John. Okay? Now, this here, all other enrollees have gone through the same underwriting process and been treated equally. Okay? So there's equality here that everybody has to go through the same test. Now, what happens to John? Eligible to join another pool designed for his situation, called a high-risk pool. And we were we were actually the second ones. Connecticut was the first one that created a high-risk pool. And right now, there's 36 states that copied what we have. And that the federal government now has have their federal pool. Now, since 76, we had MCHA. John's monthly medical cost is $1,000. His MCHA premium is $500. The law says if the average premium, if you don't have a health issue, is $400, MCHA's maximum premium could only be 25% more to keep it affordable. So now it's $500. So the deficit is $500. Remember, the premiums are, or the claims are $1,000. The MCHA premium that the individual's paying is $500. So somebody's got to come up with the $500. And that's the assessment. That's the 2.5% that only the fully insured group, 26% of the population in Minnesota, pays. Okay? So what happens at the end of each year, MCHA sends a bill to all the carriers, Medica, Blue Cross, and says, hey, your share of picking up this other $500, because you're the ones who decline the individual. Now, the state's not going to pay for this because it's your responsibility, and that is exactly what the insurance companies do. They pay the assessment. So there's no state taxes or income taxes coming from that. Who's paying the 2.5%? The healthy people in the pool. Okay? They're being charged at. When I go out on a renewal, there it is. It's listed. MCHA tax or assessment, 2.5%. So that's part of their renewal. So the employers are paying for that are fully insured. Okay? So there's no state money on this. Plus, you only got 26% of Minnesota's paying for it, even though all Minnesotans are eligible for it. Okay? So there's a little unfairness in there. Okay, John's guaranteed issue coverage through MCHA. Now, MCHA assessment makes it possible for guaranteed health insurance for unhealthy health risk individuals. Now, the 2.5% is for 2010. It's adjusted each year based on the volume of claim versus premium collected. On average, the people, you know, remember we're saying that they have to pay 25% more than the rest of the individuals buying individual policies on the individual market? This is, their premium is usually about half of what MCHA pays. Because I think a number was thrown out that the insurance companies get assessed about $150 million. That means there was like $300 million in claims. The people, the 30,000 people in MCHA, or 27,000, they only paid $150 million, and that difference, that $150 million, is the assessment. Okay. Assessment is paid only by fully insured. I already said that. 26%, yep. If all Minnesotans were assessed equally, the 2.5% assessment could be reduced dramatically, or we could get more people to qualify for the high-risk plans and reduce premiums for others in the risk pools. That's the most important thing, is why are people uninsured? Cost. Remember, who brought up the question with 61%? Somebody brought up a question about what makes up the uninsured in Minnesota. And according to Department of Health, 61% of the uninsured in Minnesota are individuals that currently are eligible for a government health plan. Okay? And did you know out of that 61%? Their data is unbelievable. They have rate your health as poor, fair, good, or excellent. You know what percent out of the whole 9% of the uninsured rates their health as poor? 3%. So what's that telling you? Who's uninsured? The sick people or the healthy people? It's the healthy people. And that's who you need to bring to the pool, is the healthy people. And that's what we do. We have to go out and find healthy people to bring to the pool. That's the only reason the insurance companies keep us around. Because if we don't bring healthy people, you know what they do? They say, go to MCHA. And then we get paid $50. That's good. Okay? A lot of us don't even take the $50 because that's our job. Okay. Now, summary of risk pools. Individual private insurance coverage. Employer group insurance. So on individual private insurance, there's individual risk pool, and then you got the high risk pool. Then you got the lowest premium to the highest premium. And then your employer group, you got fully insured, self-insured, and you got anywhere from low to high premiums in there, and what drives the rate is basically the health of the group. Now, the health insurance agents, predominantly independent contractors. Basically, we don't get paid unless we bring good risk to the pool. Okay, we're 1099 employees. We're not W-2. Job description. Our job is insure the uninsured and keep people insured continuously. That's why we get paid month after month, because we get calls all the time where you know Bill says, hey, Bill or Greg, I'm going to get rid of my health insurance because I want to buy a boat, or you know, I got to improve on a house. The average premium in Minnesota for an individual is $4,860 for health care. Okay? Now, this here, becoming insured. Currently, there are two methods of becoming insured. Some buy insurance, they have an immediate need. And then most are sold insurance. I know sold is sometimes kind of a hard word to take, but what you have is buying and selling insurance. Individuals who buy insurance are those individuals that call a health insurance company or agent. If I get a call from an individual that I don't know, you know my first question is, what's the worst thing with your health history? Okay? I mean, healthy people don't call us. Okay? Now, they understand they have a need for insurance. That's why they called us. They expect to have medical claims in the very near future. They're hoping their premium will be less than their claims. Because they always want to know how much it's going to cost. Okay? Now, and they're often high risk. Individuals that are sold, these are individuals that don't call us. They have no immediate medical need. Okay? You got to remember, 10% drives 90% of your cost. The other 90% of people are not hardly having any claims. So they're the ones that we have to go find to bring to the pool. And that's what you have to also do with your government programs, because you got a large segment of healthy people that qualify. If you bring them into the pool, then you could get a lower rate from the insurance companies. Now, they believe their premium will be more than their claims. Agents seek them out prospecting. Now, they must attract healthy people to the pool and must keep them insured over the long term, even the years they have no claims. Companies compensate agents only if we bring the good risk. Now, this here, protecting the risk pool. Without agents selling to healthy individuals, the insurance company suffers adverse selection, because the only people that are calling up the insurance company are people that are willing to pay less than what they're going to get back. Okay? People who are going to have to pay more than what they think they're going to get back, they don't call. So, adverse selection creates higher insurance premiums for everybody, and it eliminates healthy people from joining a risk pool. That's why we want to join with you to help control the cost of health care, because the healthy people are the ones dropping the insurance. It's not the individuals that need the health care. Now, eventually, only individuals
Mr.
with high DeTillo, claims...
If I could just for a moment, we've got about 1 minute.
Okay.
So if you can wrap up a little bit, and then we'll kind of summarize things and move on.
All done.
Well, I want to...
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I know the time constraints required you to move rather quickly through some very important information, but I dare say I suspect a lot of people in this audience, both here at the table as members as well as in the audience, may have never heard the details of what goes into insuring the vast majority of Minnesotans. And I hope it's clear to a lot of people, in summary, to a certain extent, that a lot of this thing, underwriting and the selling of insurance, is designed to keep people solvent so we have affordable coverage being delivered to people. If you don't do that properly, people go bankrupt, they lose health care coverage. Even under government programs, there would have to be some way of doing that. And what agents do for our communities and for the individuals in Minnesota for health insurance is a tremendous service. And so I want to thank you all for being here and helping us understand that. Mr. Tyler.
Mr. Chair, can I grab the last 30 seconds of the last minute? Just to direct us to slide number 22, just very briefly, because we're talking about reform, and that's part of the title of this committee and so on. I think as far as reform, the application of these market-based principles that we've just discussed at length, potentially to the publicly insured populations, can potentially and significantly reduce costs overall, as well as address some of the driving forces behind the cost per unit escalation called cost shifting from the public to the private sector. So those are some of the things that we would like to look at in more depth as well. So the application of these underwriting principles, et cetera, to the public programs, we believe, ultimately will provide the silver bullet that we're all looking for affordability of health insurance for all. Thank you.
Very good. And if members have other questions, we'll try to get those answered too. I think you have contact information in your materials. I want to thank you for the presentation. Members, real quickly, we are not meeting tomorrow, of course. We have the One Minnesota conference over at the Humphrey Institute, which you're encouraged to attend. Next week, we will meet at our regularly scheduled time and on our regularly scheduled days. And with that, if there aren't any other questions, we'll call the meeting adjourned.